these systems were not ordained by God. They are man-made. They can be changed. They can be adapted, you know? And that's the part that I find unbelievably frustrating, because nobody should have to live in a tin can anywhere.
Innovations in Sustainable Finance, a University of St. Gallen podcast by Julian Kölbel.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Innovations in Sustainable Finance. This is your host, Julian Kölbel at the University of St. Gallen. Today, we are fortunate to talk to Glenn Jordan. Glenn Jordan is a co-founder of Empower, and that's a housing platform that helps families in Africa who are shut out of traditional mortgage markets move into affordable and climate-resilient homes. I'm really excited about this conversation because it brings a bunch of innovation into sustainable finance, and I can't wait to dig in all the stuff you're doing. But first of all, Glenn, welcome to the show.
Great. Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Wonderful. So you are sitting in Nairobi as we speak in front of a big world map. Is that also where your offices are located?
No. We're at COVID, a child of COVID.
Okay.
So in fact, we are just scattered all over the world. So we came about as remotely. So while I'm currently in Nairobi, I actually live in the Netherlands, but I travel extensively across Africa.
Great. So, I mean, this geographic reach that you have with your company into the African continent is part of what I find so interesting. And there's lots of details we're going to get into. This is going to be a slightly technical podcast that comes with the innovation that is going on here. But before we do that, can you just give us the elevator pitch? What does Empower do?
Sure. So Empower provides finance, housing finance for the mortgage excluded. In a nutshell, that's what we do. The principle of that is that 85% of income in emerging markets is informal. And by that, what we mean is it's variable, intermittent, and mostly unrecorded. Now, as you know, in order to qualify for a mortgage, and there is only one housing product, and that's a mortgage. So across the world, there's one housing product. So in order to qualify for a mortgage, you need to have a formal proof of income, and you need to maintain consistent payments for 20 years. Now, that is just out of the reach of the vast majority of the emerging market world, because that's not how people earn. If you can imagine, for most people in the developed world, I think the closest we get into it really is people like Uber drivers, the gig economy. Is how most people in the emerging markets work. They are basically gig workers. So the constantly incomes comes in on a daily basis. If lucky, it's on a cash basis or an unrecorded basis, you know, mobile money. And that's how it works. And therefore, nobody qualifies for a mortgage. That doesn't mean to say that people can't afford to buy a house. It just means they are excluded from the ability to get a loan to buy a house. And that's what we do, is we provide a mechanism for those excluded people to get access to housing finance.
Got it. Okay. So it is basically the way that mortgages and the way to get them, the process is designed, is just incompatible how most people earn their income in developing countries. And your focus is on Africa. So can you give us some rough numbers to set the scene? So what is the housing situation in Africa? How much money is flowing and how big is the problem in some sense?
Yeah. Okay. Just to give you a statistic to start, in Mozambique, when we started our project, there were 600 mortgages in a country of 31 million people. 600, not 600,000, 600 mortgages in a country of 31 million people. Not only is Mozambique, is that the challenge? The city of Beira lost about 80% of its housing stock in Cyclone Idai. So due to climate change, there is a massive impact on housing as well, because most of it is self-built and therefore badly built. And therefore, when climate event happens, it's badly impacted. So that gives you a sense of just the level of penetration. And that it's obviously Mozambique is extreme, but even in a country like Kenya, which is sophisticated and advanced, there are about 31,000 mortgages in a country of 50 million people. So the level of penetration, if we're lucky, is between 1% and 3%, the percentage of mortgages to GDP. compared to obviously in the developed world where there is, you know, mortgage to GDP is around about 80%. So that gives you a sense of the sort of financial aspect of it across the continent. It's a $650 billion gap right now for housing. There's a backlog of over 50 million homes across the continent. So, and again,
well, that gives you plenty to work on.
That's the understatement. If we were to provide 100,000 a year, it would still take us 500 years to address the backlog. And Africa is a growing economy, and there's mass urbanization, and it's still the youngest continent, as you know. So it's the only continent that still has a growing population and a young population, as opposed to the problems in Europe that we have with aging and reducing populations. So the problem is getting more accentuated, not less.
Okay, so it is a big problem. It is, as you are mentioning, a growing problem due to young populations and destruction that comes with climate events. Now, this is really striking, this big gap between the obvious demand for housing, and that's a very human need. Everybody wants a house or a place to live. There is income, as you say, just it's irregular. And yet there seems to be no product to serve that large community. How can it be that the financial market is so dysfunctional, if you will, in that case?
That, Julian, is the $64 million question. And that's another entire podcast on its own, because the challenge really, when we live in the emerging market, when you live in Africa, realize how, and fully understand it, after 2008, obviously, you know, there were a bunch of new rules to manage capital, to manage risk were introduced. But so many of those rules and regulations are just not relevant in emerging markets and are just actually restrictive to emerging markets. So there's no, and Africa has very little voice in the world when it comes to this kind of thing. So what happens is these rules get imposed by the world order and they just don't work. So as an example, if when you speak to a bank and you ask them to lend into this market, they have to increase their capital reserves. So by definition, what that does, it means it adds to cost. So it's not in their interest. So it's not in their interest to address this. So the rules are set in such a way that it's not conducive to the banks attempting to address this market. So they don't. It's as simple as that. They don't address it.
Okay. So that's a macro reason. And you know, as you say, maybe that's a whole separate podcast, but it's just good to understand a little bit the situation before we appreciate the one solution that you and Empower are suggesting. So risk is certainly an issue when it comes to investing in emerging markets, but there seems to be something very specific about property rights that is an issue in, I'm not sure if it was in all African countries or in specific ones. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's more specific. Obviously, there are challenges with terms of systemic issues to that point, but obviously in terms of it's more prevalent in the rural areas than it is in cities. So generally speaking, in the cities, the structures are there and are manageable. Obviously, some countries are much better than others, and that's one of the aspects that does have to be looked at in terms of risk, for sure, in terms of those cadastres, if you like, can be problematic. So again, that's part of the systemic issues. But to your point, there are both macro and micro issues that create this backlog and this, you know, lack of access for the vast majority of people.
Well, then I think with that background, we're ready to shift up a gear. You were saying that Empower provides a platform to make housing available to those who are shut out of the mortgage market. So it's a platform. So maybe tell us start by telling us who comes to the platform, which actors does the platform connect?
Yeah, so there are three major actors in the platform. So the first is the informal earning family.
Got it.
Obviously, the family who's looking for a home but does not qualify for a mortgage. The second is the property developer, because the challenge for, as you can imagine, and if you look across the continent, you will find often that there's a lot of high-end property development. So you will find lots of five-star hotels and top-end kind of houses and apartments. But below that, there's nothing. And obviously, if there's no mortgages, there's a huge gap between those who can afford to either pay cash for their homes or do qualify for a mortgage, and then the rest. So, but if you can't sell your product, why would you develop for that market? You can imagine. So that prevents that supply. And then the third is capital. So to that point, if it's not banks who provide that, and then repackage that and sell it on to longer term investors, which is how it works in our part of the world, who invests into the structure? So a key part of that is generally it's pension funds, et cetera, who invest into mortgages because they have long-term perspectives and are looking for consistent income. But if that market is unsophisticated, there's also a mismatch. And so again, in the African environment, oftentimes those investors are crowded out by government. But in our environment, we link those three together because it can't go through the bank. We need direct investment into this infrastructure to allow this to happen. So it's around meeting the needs of each of these players in the ecosystem to address the entire ecosystem. So Empower is not just although in my, you asked for the elevator pitch, it's providing finance. In order to do that, we've had to transform the entire system. And that's where fintech helps immensely in being able to do that, because we're able to provide mechanisms that meet the needs of investors, developers, and the families in such a way that it meets all of their needs in one ecosystem and everybody gets a view of those cash flows from end to end.
Great. I think fintech innovation and cash flows is the key word now to go a little bit into the details, because from afar, as you've described the situation, of course, there's something rational about being careful to invest in emerging markets because they are risky for various reasons. But then technology can potentially help to lower these risks or make them better visible. And I that's where Empower is going. So I'd like to first understand this making an irregular and informal income, as you call it, making a valid basis for a mortgage or a mortgage type product. So what needs to happen there and how does fintech come in?
Yeah, so exactly that. The first part of it and where tech at that point really helps is the ability to manage that intermittent, that variability. So as you can imagine, because what happens is because people earn intermittently and variably, those payments happen variably and intermittently. So how do you manage that process? So obviously you have to manage the repayments in such a way that you know if somebody's ahead of payments, is ahead of schedule, behind schedule, or needs to be managed in and out of the process. And that's where the technology and that data helps. That's at the individual level. And then from an investor point of view, it's looking at it at a portfolio level. So it's how do we de-risk that? How do we provide mechanisms that fundamentally de-risk this process that makes it investable and smooths that income to provide a mortgage type product despite the variability and intermittency? So it's around building the portfolio view of that and enabling the offsets, if you like, of those individual variables to smooth out and be able to provide the returns as well as the data that meet the needs of the investor. In terms of the developer enables, what supports the developer is the ability to get cash flow, because they can effectively sell the product and move on to the next development. So what happens is that—
The product being a house or a development.
Exactly. So they can get paid for their house, because if they have to rely on just what we've been saying, there isn't any financial product to help somebody buy that house at an affordable level.
Yeah. And then they are exposed to the irregular payments, which is very difficult for them to deal with.
Now, if they've got the capital to provide that over time. So that's the first part. You're expecting them to have the capital to be able to provide that time payment, and they don't. So you're asking them to be a bank, which they're not. So that's the point. So that's the process. So that investment
allows... So that's what Empower does for them.
Exactly.
On their side.
Exactly.
And just for me to imagine this, so I imagine if you have an informal income and it's in cash, then of course it's impossible to make that visible for any potential lender. If it's recorded electronically, that at least you can sort of say, well, it may be irregular, but you know, over a longer time horizon, you see something right there, and that gives you an idea of how that might continue into the future. Is that part of the screening process or the approach?
Absolutely, and it's the recordal process. So we record all of those transactions, exactly, all of those payments. Those are recorded, and what that starts to do is it's bringing people from informality into formal. Because to that point, it makes the invisible visible. And so often, if you look at affordability studies, you know, you'll see housing affordability studies, which is always, in a sense, is madness. Because if we do an academic study, we do it on what we can see. So in other words, we look at affordability. So we will look at the salary, as an example, of a policeman or a teacher, and then go, a house is unaffordable based on that salary. But nobody in the developing world has one source of income, because exactly that, it's unaffordable to live on that basis. So everybody's got a side hustle. Everybody's doing something. Everybody's got something else in their offing, whether they're growing crops and, you know, on their back garden, or whether they, you know, their relative is providing income from diaspora, you know, from overseas, or whatever it is. There's always other money flowing around the system. And so that's the part that's completely unrecorded. 85% of it is unrecorded. So that's the point. So it's around starting to capture those into a product, because people are paying for it anyway. And when I say that, people have to pay to live, and they pay in a rental, even if it's just for land on which they have to build a shack, they pay rental. So that's happening, but it's all unrecorded. And this gives us the ability to start building that, to start moving families from informality to formality, and to provide mechanisms to start bringing them into the system in a non-exploitative way.
Great. Now, let's turn to the investors. You were mentioning pension funds. Do you have in mind African pension funds, or also developed market pension funds? And what changes for them by putting Empower in the middle? Potentially they might invest in an African bank, for instance, I suppose. So what's the difference there?
Exactly. So effectively what we're doing there is in a developed world environment, the bank would take the mortgages and securitize them. In effect, that's what we're doing. So that's why it becomes investable into this infrastructure. So for the first time, we're able to take formal capital and de-risk it to the extent that it becomes investable into the informal sector. So despite the fact that's the key part, that's the key of what we're doing, is really making the informal segment, that 85%, investable for the very first time. Because to date, the only mechanism has been through the bank, and the bank can't do it.
How is that different from microfinance and microlending, which I think has a similar overall idea? There's people that are excluded from the formal financial market, and then, you know, by the same token, capital from the developed world gets distributed in small loans. Is that related, or how is it different?
It's vastly different, and I'll tell you why. The two reasons that it's different. One is it's asset-backed. There's an asset.
Which one? The Empower.
Exactly. Because you've got the home. We're funding offtake. We're not funding construction. It's a key element of what we do. It's a finished unit. That it's like a mortgage. Okay? So it's asset-backed. There is an asset backing when the rent-to-own contract happens. So the point around that is this: there's an asset. So it's not
right.
It's not micro or unsecured lending.
That's the first big difference.
Part. Okay. It's a huge difference. The second part is cost. Because the thing with unsecured lending or micro lending, and this is often, unfortunately, what happens in the context, as I'm sure you're aware, is that it can be used for good, or it can be used for investment purposes, or it can be used for consumption. Either way, it tends to be very expensive for the end user.
Expensive in terms of the interest rate. So can you, what are then, that's an interesting concrete point. So what are the interest rates roughly for these non securitized loans and how do they compare to the interest rate that people would pay via Empower?
Okay, so in an unsecured loan, people, it often can be up to 25% per month is not beyond the realms of possibility.
Wow.
Yeah. Okay. Which is why it's very, and there are a lot of, the biggest investor into micro lending in emerging markets is? Do you know who the biggest? Switzerland, correct. The Swiss pension fund.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why? Because it's highly lucrative. Okay. It's highly lucrative. Unfortunately, it's also exploitative. Because the reality is it's the good payers pay for the bad payers. They are the ones who cover the cost. And it's you know very lucrative for pension funds to invest into. And so micro lending has boomed, as you know, unsecured lending has boomed across the world because it's highly lucrative. So that, and it's highly lucrative for investors, not for the end users, unfortunately. So to that point, it tends to be extractive, is my point, as opposed to contributory. So that's the first part. The second part is because it's asset-backed, we're able to reduce that cost significantly. So from 25% per month, we're aiming in, so as an example, just to give you an example, in Mozambique where we started, the mortgage rate was 29% per annum, and our loan, effective loan rate was 12% per annum. Now, 12% is still high, but it's a significant reduction from 29.
Yes. Okay. And how many tenants are currently living in houses that have been financed and set up this way? How are things going on the ground?
It's still, numbers are still small, unfortunately. So to look at actual numbers is always misleading because the numbers look small, but actually what we have to look at is relativity. Okay. So the point is around what we're able to achieve relative to what's existing, because our constraint is capital. So it's to raise the capital. So, and we're in that wonderful chicken and egg situation. The capital providers want security and data. And in order to get data, we need more capital. So we get caught in that conundrum. So that's the challenge. So the numbers are relatively small, but to give an example, we've been able to grow the home loan market in some countries by 5% already, just through this process.
Just you. That sounds
just
huge.
Just Empower. Okay. It's massive, but the numbers are still small. The quantums are still small. The numbers are still small, but the relativity is massive to this. And just to give an example of that, at the portfolio level, we have 100% performance. And that always sounds misleading because that says that's not possible. But the way it's structured is that because individuals with deposits, because it's a rental agreement, and because this is an opportunity for people to build an asset for which they would not normally have access, they will actually work extremely hard to keep access to that. So they will actually self-regulate to move out before it becomes a problem. So actually people, you'll find that they move out from a rental agreement if they can't keep it going, and then you have another tenant who moves in. So
I didn't quite understand the point. Why would people do that? I mean, that means leaving your home. That must be painful.
Because it's a rent-to-own product, not a mortgage. So the transfer happens when the payment has been made in full.
Yeah. Oh, they would move out temporarily to still maintain the option to eventually move back in.
Exactly.
Okay,
exactly.
I get it.
Exactly.
Okay, because they're building up equity in their own home. So the longer they stay in there, the bigger the carrot to actually keep going.
100%. Exactly that. And for the first time, they have an opportunity to get access to a home, which they wouldn't normally have.
And the difference is they have an opportunity to start even with an informal income and sort of with a sort of relatively low barrier to entry. So otherwise, they just wouldn't even start.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Plus, and also I think this must be relevant, they will live somewhere before they move into that place, which also has costs. So they can definitely use that.
Exactly. That's exactly the issue. And that's the irony because What people expect is, you know, if you look at you need to save, or you need to have a, you know, standard payment. So you need to have all these savings in place. But exactly that, you're already living somewhere and paying rent anyway. So the point around that, and actually, if you look at what has emerged in Africa, is self-build to a large extent.
Yeah.
So people will live somewhere and build their own place somewhere else. And so effectively, what we're doing is the reverse of that. So we're providing a professionally built home that enables somebody to move in immediately, but self-build payment-wise over time, because they save towards their product, towards their own home, as in when they can contribute. So it's reversing things, which meets the needs.
Which brings us to another area of innovation, which I think is exciting, which is the way that things are being built. You were first making the contrast between high-end developments. They may be built very nicely, but then self-built homes, even many people will be skilled builders, but still there are limitations to what you can do on your own, right? So doing that professionally just opens the door to building in a different way. So can you please describe to us what's possible on that front?
Yeah, and that also comes back to, you know, one of the things that you look at, for example, if you look at property rights as a challenge, across the world, we're looking very much at modular and circular construction methodologies. So that's the ability to, instead of the old traditional way of building, which is masses of concrete, which is carbon intensive, but to build in structures that can be assembled and disassembled and reutilized, or from an environmental perspective, material can be reutilized so that it's not destroyed when there's a change. And that is really interesting because in our context, that opens up opportunity to not be linked to the ground, which then disincentivizes people from trying to adapt the cadastre. Because in fact, that modular mechanism becomes the ability to actually not link the building to the earth in such a strict manner that it actually is more of a flexible, it's more flexible. So when the units are smaller, and we're using it just in smaller examples at the moment, is the ability then becomes to effectively move the building if there's a problem. So again, it's another de-risking mechanism.
If the title deed to the land is somehow unclear or disputed, which, you know, would normally just preclude me from building anything on that land because it might just be lost, I can still build a modular home and a house and just sort of move it in the worst event, like a trailer, you would.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Keep the house and keep most of the value. Okay, that I think that is in terms of working around a legal issue that seems to be widespread. That seems to me, you know, it's like a simple innovation, but it could be really consequential.
That's, you see, and I think that's what we've been trying to do at Empower at every step of the chain, is we've looked at reality. Because what often happens is we and this sounds really bizarre, but often what happens is because of the top-down approach that we're talking about, the systems that we have, the financial systems that we've been talking about this entire podcast, we take those systems and we try and impose them into a world where it doesn't fit. And what we've been saying right from the start is, how do we look at reality and then try and find a solution to that reality? And if we approach the problem in that way, then we create innovative solutions that meet the needs. And then it's a question. So for example, to your point, it's then meeting the needs of both the investors and the users in a way that then we're de-risking it, you know, at multiple levels, environmentally and financially, which is key to the success of actually being able to take this forward and scale it and meeting the reality, the needs of the real needs on the ground, as opposed to saying, all right, well, let's invest millions and millions to improve the cadastre, as an example.
And I imagine it will also give developers an incentive to sort of, well, develop in this area, drive down unit costs. I imagine these modular houses will be quite standardized and therefore
absolutely.
So is that something that is happening in Africa? Is that an industry that is growing and developing?
It's emerging. Let's put it that
it's
way.
Emerging?
It's emerging. Yep. It's certainly not mature, and it's certainly not yet ubiquitous, but it's certainly emerging. And you know, concepts are emerging, methodologies are emerging, and new ways of thinking are emerging. And I think that's the interesting and exciting part.
That is very interesting. You were also mentioning the environmental aspect of that. So is it the case that these modules are, you said they are recyclable, or maybe it's easier to fix after a disaster because you can sort of just replace certain parts?
Exactly. So that's the whole intention of what we're also seeking to achieve, is to ensure that we don't replicate just what's happened in China. So obviously, you know, with the Chinese, if when we get the finance right, there'll be a building boom. Okay. What we don't want to do is then have millions of tons of concrete, okay, and which is environmentally detrimental. So we want to make sure that we're supporting and promoting the most environmentally productive ways that we can of construction. So we want to be able to support that. And as you know, finance dictates that, actually. That's the way it works. So what we need to ensure is that we're not significantly increasing costs for people who can afford it least, obviously, but at the same time, meeting the needs of the users, again, of the contractors and of investors and of the planet. So that's the you know, a key part of what we're seeking to achieve in this whole approach.
Have you lived or spent time in one of these modular houses? I've never been in one. I'm just wondering if they are wobbly, if you will, but maybe it's the wrong idea, probably. If I just imagine I have to move into one of those, I'm not sure I want to.
No, completely, no. Not wobbly at all. No, you wouldn't know, to be honest. You wouldn't know. And part of that is you'll have actually been into them. You'll find it in most factories across Europe. They are built in that way. In a way that is actually more modular. It's now just extending to housing. It started off in sort of industrial and office space and is moving into residential now. But no, the only thing that is really different is this. Sometimes if you knock on the wall, there's a slightly different feel, but that's all you would notice. Apart from that, you wouldn't notice at all.
Okay, so I'll refrain from the wall knocking, but that's good to know that the house is... Yeah, it just sounds different. Okay. Well, that's a minor thing. Okay. Now, I think so. We've understood the Empower platform and what it connects, and the innovative bits, as far as we went into them, are, you know, recording informal income on digitally and making it thus visible and eligible for financial product, and building in a different way and allowing developers to build in a different way. So it's based a blockchain, most of this. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? Why is it based on a blockchain? What are the advantages here?
Yeah, and it's very interesting, because when we started saying we were building on the blockchain, everybody assumed, particularly a couple of years ago, everybody assumed crypto. Okay.
Yeah.
So we need to be very clear, not crypto, the technology that underlines crypto is blockchain. And that technology enables us to provide immutable and immediate data, and indisputable. So the point around that is what we wanted to do hence Empower, was to ensure that we support the least empowered people, generally speaking, in this environment. So often what happens in this environment is, if somebody makes a payment, for example, and that payment is not recorded, and there's a dispute, how do you prove that payment? So the whole thing here was to ensure that we record that payment so that at the end it becomes indisputable. So it's the payments and the transactions are recorded on the blockchain. Therefore then becomes ensuring that. So that's the one aspect. The other aspect is on a rent-to-own basis. And MiCA in Europe has supported this now. The legislation has caught up with where we started, is also the ability to have part ownership. So you have a digital asset that represents the underlying asset, and you have part ownership of that asset. So as you pay it off, you can ensure that we retain ownership of that asset, and that's also blockchain that's recorded on the blockchain. And that becomes a mechanism by which you can have part ownership and then have part distribution of funds. The third level, which we haven't yet implemented, but we're always seeking to do, was to your point around housing finance is long-term. It's long-term, and investment into emerging markets is always, there's always currency risk.
Yes.
So is there a mechanism by which we can manage currency risk effectively and reduce the cost of that? So we can reduce that risk and reduce the cost of that risk, because ultimately it's always the end user who pays that cost. And again, it's the people who can least afford it. So what we wanted to do was build that. So right from the day one, we were laying the foundations for us to be able to do that. And that's another whole podcast, which I'd love to go into at some stage with you, because it's also applicable to sustainable finance, et cetera. But it's literally another whole innovation in and of itself, but it's a mechanism by which we can de-risk and reduce the cost of that through the utilization of blockchain.
Right. So, but just to make sure everybody tags along. So the problem is generally if I invest Swiss francs in Mozambique,
yep,
and the tenant will pay their rent in, what's the currency?
Metical.
There can be a mismatch. If the metical loses value compared to the Swiss franc, then there's somehow, you know, the returns don't fit my expectations anymore. So there needs to be something in the middle that takes out this currency risk. And you're using the blockchain to do that. We're not going to go into the details, but that's what it's good for.
Yeah.
Got it. Okay. Does the blockchain also reduce costs? I imagine there's a bunch of paperwork that otherwise would have need to be done. That seems to be a key advantage.
Absolutely. A significant, and yeah, thank you for highlighting that, because that is one of the things I should have mentioned. Absolutely. It's part of that because it reduces the need effectively. And when I say the need, if you have informality, and by informality, I mean a lack of systems and processes, as you can imagine, audits become extremely difficult and very, very costly. The blockchain enables us to reduce that need. So effectively, exactly that. The transaction is recorded. It's then immutable. It cannot be adapted in any shape or form. So auditing becomes a very simple process. We can audit those transactions very, very easily. And actually, we can utilize technology for that audit.
How about the second aspect you mentioned, that the property is also reflected as a you know, in a digital form on the blockchain? So that often seems to be a challenge to just make sure that these two things are consistent with each other, in the sense of, you know, is the house still there? And if say, you know, it gets destroyed for one of another reason, that needs to be then also reflected on the blockchain, right? You cannot say, well, digitally, it's still there. So how do you manage that? Is that's, I guess there's some level where somebody needs to go in and check if there's a discussion around that.
Well, fortunately, because we're end to end in terms of that system, for us, it's relatively easy, because obviously, because we know it's there and somebody's paying for it. So, you know, it's only in use for the time period that it's needed if there's a shared ownership. Once that ownership is then transferred effectively, the need for it is removed. So because we are there and we're managing that process, we have to know that it's there, and we have to know that somebody's living in it, and we have to know that somebody's paying for it in order to manage this whole process end to end. So that's part of it. All that it then does is enables us to manage the ownership aspect of it in a way that we couldn't traditionally.
Right.
You know, traditionally, I can't own 21% of my property today and 22% tomorrow.
Yeah. Well, yeah, at least it would be enormously cumbersome to update that contract every month.
Exactly. Yes, okay. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Now, I want to zoom out a little bit, and, you know, this is such a beautiful innovation, and I can see how it addresses a dire need on several fronts. If there is such a clear need, and, you know, people in principle could afford these houses, it just begs the question that, you know, if you take one step back, you know, why are you the only one doing this? Isn't there, you know, a natural pull for someone to provide this So maybe you can comment on this, and perhaps in particular, because you already mentioned the Chinese property boom. I know very little about Africa, but what I have read that somehow Chinese companies and banks are very active building infrastructure. So aren't they doing this already? And if they don't, why not? Or what is going on here?
Yeah. So to answer your question, it's around the reason it hasn't been happening is because there is this huge lack of understanding of the informal sector. It's a them and us. The people who make the decisions sit in air-conditioned offices, drink cappuccino, and work on MacBooks. And these are the people who make decisions around financial decisions. The reality for them, for people on the ground, is so far removed from that.
Yeah.
It's two different worlds. It's two completely different worlds. So when I first started introducing this in some boardrooms, I get met with just literally eyes glaze over, and it's just like, no, thank you. It's too far a leap. To actually, this world is literally, it's too far away for me to understand. It's much easier to invest into a shopping center in Zurich than it is to invest into this ecosystem that I don't know and understand. And that historically has been, and so that's the one aspect. The other aspect, as I explained, is our systems and processes don't allow it to date. So a housing product is provided by a bank. And a bank does a credit check on you. And it's in order for you, it to do that, you have to have data. So when it comes to that, and that's just the process. So if there's no data, again, and that's where when I mentioned earlier about taking into account reality, if we say there is, the reality is that there is no data. So what happens in, and I've been to many conferences where the banks will turn around and say, we need more data.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in order to make this decision. But the data doesn't exist because by definition, it's informal and therefore out of the system. So there is no data. So I'm trying to impose a system of a credit check into an environment where it doesn't work. It's as simple as that. So therefore, I immediately go, I can't deal with this market. That's out beyond the realms of my market. I can't deal with it. Sorry. And so it immediately gets excluded.
How is it then that it seems just incredible frankly, that banks, local banks in Switzerland have mobile payment apps. People pay mobile all the time. I think that must be a thing in Africa too. So aren't they slowly waking up to the fact that there are some transactions that they could actually look at? I mean, I find it just amazing that Empower. I understand it's a very difficult sector you picked, and this is the informal sector, and you know, it's probably not the most lucrative market to be in. So maybe that's the whole explanation, but it seems to be at least making small steps entering that market. Is any of that happening, or are you just literally the only one there? I'm just curious how the situation is.
It's very interesting because at the African Urban Forum, which was the meeting of all the African Union heads of state earlier this year, for the very first time, affordable housing got onto the agenda, number one, because it's as you know, it's a hot topic all around the world. And secondly, for the very first time, they said we have to address this informal market.
Hmm. But that was because recently.
This year, for the first time.
You've been working on it for 5 years, so you were clearly a little bit ahead of the parade.
Correct. But so the point is absolutely. But it requires sitting down with a blank sheet and starting from scratch. And that's very difficult for most. It's the same as unsecured lending didn't emerge from the banking sector. It emerged outside the banking sector. And it's a similar process. This has to emerge from outside and become mainstream. It can't emerge from inside the system because the system is just too structured and too, you know, if you'd spoken I'm not sure of the exact timelines, but some time back historically about unsecured lending, people would have said, you're mad. You can't lend money without an asset backing.
Mm.
And yet now we talk about that all the time. It's the norm, but literally some years back it wasn't. So I think that's where we are in this journey. And yes, unsecured lending, as we went through earlier, is far more lucrative and far, far shorter term and far less capital intensive. And I think that's another key aspect to this, is the capital intensity of what we're doing. You know, often when I talk to, you know, to investors, it's like, but where's your capital going to come from? You know, it can't come from us. And so I go, I know it's not going to come from you, but the point is we have to make it investable for those who do want to invest into the space.
But that sort of, that pulls together these two things, right? It is capital intensive because there's going to be an asset which the tenant can eventually own and which serves as collateral.
Exactly.
In the meantime.
Exactly.
So at the end of the day, this is really making it technologically work that capital can serve the needs of those who need it most in some sense.
That's exactly it. Exactly it. And you know, that's one of the reasons why I got into this space is to see people living in a tin can, in a corrugated iron shack, in 40 degree heat, and expecting people to live like that, and expecting families to educate their children and come out of that to study. Can you imagine trying to study? How do you lift yourself out of that environment if you're living in that environment? And I get quite passionate about it because I just find it, to your point, and it's not, there's no reason for that. These systems were not ordained by God. They are man-made. Mm. They can be changed. They can be adapted, you know? And that's the point. And that's the part. That's the part that I find unbelievably frustrating, because nobody should have to live in a tin can anywhere.
I absolutely agree. But now, it is possible now for investors and, you know, pension for institutional or retail to come in as investors. Is that currently already a possibility? Is that wrapping up?
So that's what we're currently working on. So in multiple mm-hmm. countries. So for example, we're now actually busy with a listing an entity in Mozambique. So as an investable entity, so the pension funds, because one of the requirements of pension funds in Mozambique is it has to be a listed entity. So we're mm-hmm. actually listing the structure so that they can
exactly.
actually.
When is that planned?
That's planned for actually Q4. So it's still happening this year.
Okay.
So absolutely, for exactly that purpose, to raise that. So that's one of the structures. And then we're busy with bond structures in other countries, and multiple structures or you know, in different countries, different structures are required in order to put this together. But very much so, you know, obviously meeting the needs of these markets as we go country by country.
That is exciting, because that is really where you, if you list, then, you know, you really sort of make the link between the capital markets proper and that informal sector you're exposed on the other side of the platform. So I hope that goes well.
And thank you.
Should be one of the listings that the financial press should be talking about.
We certainly hope so.
We're already giving the listeners of this podcast a little advance warning of what's about to happen in Q4.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Mark your calendars. And, you know, it would be fun to come back afterwards and see how things went. So maybe we can reconnect on that front now that we've started this story.
Okay. Absolutely. Would love to yeah. because as you can imagine, it has been a journey. It is a journey. And yes. It emerges as we go. And, you know, we, in typical startup fashion, we have to learn and adapt and change and, you know, in order to make things work. But so it's been a fascinating journey and it's not a struggle to get up in the morning, I must be honest, because
very good. That's a good thing to have. Now, so since we're already looking to the future, I wanted to cap it off your vision for Empower, but, you know, more generally for this African real estate market over the coming decade. What are you hoping to see? What worries you, and what are you really bullish on?
So our intention obviously is to be Pan-African, so as to be across the continent and start chipping away at that 50 million backlog. That's the passion. That's the objective. The scale of that, I think, is going to be My hope and wish is that it's going to be one of those things that starts off that we thought was going to be quicker, but it actually starts off slower. But as we prove this more and more, it's going to ramp up very quickly. That's my real hope. Because of the way it works, because of the methodology of supporting the developer, we're able to really take this to scale, as you can imagine, because this is not about waiting for big projects. It's not about large projects and large numbers. This is about supporting smaller developers at scale. So that's the real opportunity here for scaling that. And that's our real passion, to take and make this happen. And that's the hope. Downside, the fear is really just, it's really interesting because I had a meeting earlier today. And part of that in that discussion was, the question from the financier was, do developers struggle to understand this concept? And I said, developers get it in 10 minutes. Financiers take hours, if I'm lucky. Okay. And that was an interesting part of the conversation. So my hope is that as this starts to happen, as we start to get success, like we've just been talking about with listings and pension funds, it just becomes an absolute no-brainer. And this just becomes a required asset class that people just start investing into in such a way that we can really, as you say, use capital to meet the needs of people while providing the needs of capital as well, but to be focused more on the needs of the people who need it most, as opposed to, as I mentioned, another shopping center, another top-end shopping center in Zurich would be nice. I would, from my time in Zurich, I think there've been enough. there are enough shops in Zurich.
Fantastic. And then, the final thing, what are you really, really bullish on? So what is exciting for you?
I think that's the exciting part for me, because I think when that happens, the numbers are going to scale. And that's for me, the exciting part. So the more, if I always say, if I could bottle, if I could bottle some of the feedback that when you go to somebody's home, who's moved into a home for the first time, where they can lock the door, where they have running water, where they have, security, safety, they have safety from a storm, they're protected from the heat. When you see that happiness, I wish I could bottle that in a way that I could share with people who are watching and listening to this, because then I know it would happen at the scale that I'm bullish on. But my belief is that is going to happen. And that's what I'm bullish on, is that bottle is going to be uncorked, and we're going to be able to address that, and we're going to have millions of families in improved living conditions, being able to educate their children and live in decent living conditions. That's what I'm bullish on. And that's as I say, that's what gets me up in the morning.
Fantastic. What a beautiful picture. And I only hope that this will become a reality, that vision. And thank you so much for spending time with us on this podcast. And I wish you all the very best. And I'm curious to follow Empower's story in the months and years going forward.
Not at all. Thanks, Julian. Appreciate it, and really appreciate your time.
Take care.
You too.
Innovations in Sustainable Finance, a University of St. Gallen podcast by Julian Kölbl.